welcome to this episode of Season 4 of The Common Bridge, where policy and current events are discussed in a fiercely nonpartisan manner. The host, Richard Helpe, is a philanthropist, entrepreneur, and political analyst who has reached over 3.5 million listeners, viewers, and readers around the world. The Common Bridge is available on the Substack website and the Substack app. Just search for The Common Bridge. You can find the program on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. The Common Bridge draws guests and audiences from across the political spectrum, and we invite you to become a free or paid subscriber on your favorite medium.
Hello, welcome to The Common Bridge. I'm your host, Rich Helpe. Today, we have a guest with some great perspectives on our society today, changes in life, and we welcome from the Substack program and the Twitter feed of the same name, Show Me the Data, and we have the author of both of those, Corey. Corey, welcome to The Common Bridge. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Rich.
Corey, our audience likes to know a little bit about our guest, and if you don't mind, maybe a little bit where you spend your early years and what's been your educational or career or family arc, and what are you up to today?
So I grew up about a mile from the beach in Southern California in San Diego, which is a terrible place to grow up because that's my benchmark for life is perfection, 70 degrees with an ocean breeze. It was a great time place to grow up in the 90s, back when grunge was good and conspicuous consumption was out. And then I ended up going to Brigham Young University, got a degree in international economics. And like any true economist, I looked around and said, where can I make the most amount of money with the least amount of effort? And I went into sales. And so I've been in sales ever since. My husband, he was an EVP at a bank. And in 2020, we made the decision that he'd become a stay-at-home dad because I loved what I did. He hated what he did. I made more money. This was not our plan. It was never our plan for him to be a stay-at-home dad. But just the way life came, like right before COVID, he decided to become a stay-at-home dad. And that's our background and our situation now with the family. I've got two kids. One is 14, the other is 10. And
That is a great background where we're going to leap off into the first set of things to talk about today. I understand that you've done a significant lifestyle change and you have a series called So You Think You Want to Own a Farm. Tell us about that. What's going on with that?
Okay. So my husband grew up on a farm in Kentucky. Three bedroom house, 10 kids. He had to work to eat. He had to work to live. And I feel like that's one thing that we both had in common is that growing up during the recession in the 90s, my dad was on unemployment. If I wanted something, I had to go out and earn it myself. I couldn't just ask mom and dad for it. And he had to do it one step further, whereas if he didn't do his chores, they didn't have milk for dinner. They didn't have bread. So he grew up in this farm in Kentucky and he swore he was never going to, that's why he went to banking. I'm never going to own a farm. Farming's the worst. And, he grew to miss the farm life. He started missing it. He missed the being able to, live off the land, be self-sustaining. And I call myself like a practical prepper. I wasn't all the way prepper, but I have, my 48 hour kit, my car. I always have to take gas. You start going down the prepping rabbit hole. You just go all the way in. So I started having this feeling like, we need to be self-sufficient. I don't want to rely on anyone. I don't want to rely on the government. I don't want to rely on someone for my water. I don't want to rely on someone for my energy. If something happens, I want to know that we're going to survive. And I think most people fall into one or two categories. If the apocalypse comes, I'm either going to be a survivor or I want to die right away. There's no in between. And when people date, I'd say try to figure out what type of person you are and then marry someone with the same like aspirations. It'll make the marriage go a lot easier if you both want to survive or you both want to die. But we were living in Texas in 2018. We'd been there for about a decade, loved Texas. We put our heart and soul into building this beautiful home. It was wonderful. We had a wonderful community and we thought, okay, it's time to own some land. So we started looking for land and our plan was to open an event center on a farm and have a working farm with an event center because wedding venues were booked 2 to 3 years out. You could make a killing doing this. We had this beautiful like business plan there. We even had an investor and then COVID hit and I could see the pendulum swinging the other direction. I was like, weddings, people aren't going to be spending the big bucks on weddings anymore. They're going to elope. They're going to save their money. And this event center idea just died. It died. But we still wanted the land and we still wanted the farm. And we had looked around the country, my husband being from Kentucky and I being from San Diego. And we said, where does Kentucky meet San Diego? And that's South Carolina. I had never been even visited South Carolina, but in the middle of COVID, we decided we were moving to Charleston. And because the land out here is quite a bit less expensive than the land was in Texas, and you could live off of less because of the water. It's very humid here. There's a lot of access to water. Texas, you need hundreds of acres to have a working farm. Here, you didn't need that many acres. So we just picked up and moved to Charleston, sold our beautiful home in Texas, downsized. I hate the house I'm in right now. It's a small home. It's just not an ideal location. But we
wait a minute. I think by your husband's standards, it has room for 8 more kids, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed, it does. And we could probably have 20 more kids compared to the house you grew up in.
So you're in South Carolina, and you were thoughtful about where you were going to go, where the environment had to be somewhat self-sustaining. I can't imagine that this was a popular choice, perhaps by your friends and family. Were a lot of people wondering what the heck you were up to?
Always. Why? No one understood. You have a beautiful home. You have a community. You have good friends, good schools. You're in Texas. You know, everyone had this perception that Texas was open during COVID, but it wasn't. And I could go off on Greg Abbott for quite a long while about how he was a wet napkin in the face of tyranny. But people didn't understand why we just pick up and live this, like leave this beautiful life we'd built for a complete unknown.
So tell us about the life. Are you, and by the way, there's parts of my audience that are going to be horrified at the word prepper. And there are those that have never talked to somebody that has gone in that direction. Frankly, we used to celebrate self-reliance in the country, and we've, you know, don't do that. And my look at it was this. I was raised by the World War II generation that was part of the Great Depression. They were hungry. And so a lot of focus was on, are we going to have food? You know, eat everything on your plate. Is there going to be enough things down in the cellar and so forth? And then the current crop of adults, young adults, you know, they look down the street and they go, you know, there's a pizza place on every corner. There's a food service place. The grocery stores are overflowing. And I'm not motivated by the notion that if I don't work, I won't eat, because that's never occurred to them. But there's a lot that goes on in that supply chain before something's on someone's dinner plate and when it's in its raw form. So how far back in that supply chain are you and your husband going?
Well, we've always had a year supply of food, always. And, you know, access to water, knowing that water is life, right? You need always have access to water. So that's kind of the standard that we came into the marriage with, is this idea that, like, if we didn't have access to food or water, and it wasn't necessarily due to, wasn't going to be because of supply per se, or because in the 90s, when my dad was unemployed, we lived off of our food storage. And it wasn't that we didn't have access to food, it's that we couldn't afford it. And so you never know when that kind of event's going to occur. And so because I had lived that and he had lived that, where he had to provide for himself, so we already had this notion of like, okay, we need to be ready for anything. So we've always had a year supply of food on hand. Now we buy cows from his brother who lives in Kentucky, who will buy a full cow from him directly. On our farm, we've just started planting our garden. We don't have a crop. A traditional crop, what we have is timber, but we have enough space there for a garden for us to grow our own food. So currently, we're still very reliant on the supply chain. There's many people that have done a really great job of going off-grid and living a complete... That's not where we are. We're a hybrid, for sure, of where we're definitely going to the grocery store daily to get our food.
Well, you know, you think about things as fundamental as power, and we've seen grids failing in Texas. Have we seen grids failing in California? Couldn't be two more diametrically opposed governing philosophies in those states. We've seen banking crises with shifting, and we're told, don't worry, everything's fine. You kind of dig beneath the numbers and things can be scary, but we've always managed to come through. So I think it's positive that people are a little more self-reliant. And even if you think about things as basic as solar panels with some storage, that's less people dependent on the grid. Somebody has a well on property, less dependence on the grid and such. Do you have an idea about where you want to go with this and how you might be blogging this or reporting this to people on your Twitter feed or on your Substack page?
Yeah, I was genuinely surprised. So I got my Twitter following during COVID. I had maybe 300 followers in 2020, 2021 is where people started following me. So it was very emotional tweet that I tweeted out that day, and I did not expect the how. Like, I didn't think people would want to know how. I thought, you know, there's also experts far better than me to tell the how. Maybe the thing that makes us unique is that we are such a hybrid model. We're not living on the land that we're farming. We're still, you know, have city life. And so my plan is to just keep documenting the how on the Substack, so that if someone's in this mindset of, okay, maybe we want to do this, just give them the right questions to think about. I don't have the answers, but maybe I can help you ask the right questions, so that you can determine where or how, like, or if it's even right for you, because this is definitely not the right move for everybody.
What was that first tweet that you put out?
I think it's the one you responded to, the one that said, you know, it basically, I'll be honest, I was getting out of my truck and I saw one of my friend's vacation photos and I was like, why don't I go on vacations like her? I've worked so hard to get this point in my life. Like, why am I not on that vacation? And then I saw my little son wiggle his butt at the bees, because that's how bees communicate, you know, they wiggle their butts at each other. So my little son is like wiggling his tush at the bees to communicate. And I was like, okay, this is why. And then I wrote this tweet about, like, you know, the bees were a part of our farm that I felt like, okay, this is the last piece. We need to be completely, like, off the grid. I needed some sort of sugar source, all the benefits that come with bees. That was it. So I set this tweet off saying that, you know, it's possible to go off the grid, but you've got to make sacrifices. You know, instead of buying a new car, we bought a tractor. Instead of going on vacation, we go to work. It's possible to live this life, because my husband and I aren't wealthy. We didn't inherit wealth. We didn't sell a company. I don't play the stock market, because I worked too darn hard for my money to lose it in the stock market. So we're very normal people that were able to pull this off by doing abnormal things.
One of the things that I admire about your willingness to put yourself out there is that you're speaking to common sense. We've got this society now where people are too afraid to say anything because, oh, that speech is going to be, quote, harmful or uncomfortable or triggering. The real world can be uncomfortable. It can be harmful. It can be triggering. And, you know, you're at work and I was very uncomfortable during the training and I need to go to HR and I need to go to the local media and say this is a very bad place. And I like to ask the question, well, what's more uncomfortable, that training session or a train wreck because your training wasn't rigorous enough? And just this past week, I had dinner with some friends, both attorneys, both left of center, one very left of center. And they're talking about that, you know, quote, you know, harm and such. And I said, look, you guys both went to law school. I said, was it hard? Yes. Did people flunk out? Yes. Do you think they should have been allowed to stay? No. Well, wasn't that uncomfortable for them? And we went on to another subject from there. But I'm just going to read a couple of your quotes here. And there's two options. Average citizens who are looking at the raw data from day one are much smarter than experts and journalists. Or the experts and journalists knew the truth and intentionally misled the public. What kind of feedback are you getting on that? I see it's been retweeted 851 times.
There's a lot of people that are ready to be like, I told you so. I told you so, because we told them so. We knew in 2020 what was happening. And it's either it's one of two things, right? Either we were right or either we're smarter than the people in charge, or the people in charge were intentionally lying to us. It's one of the two.
Well, look, a third way to look at this, and we've covered this a lot on our show, was that there was just a lot of unknowns. And at the onset of COVID, I was actually asked on this program, are we doing too much in terms of, you know, lockdowns and things? And I said, we don't know, because this is a new virus. And similarly with the vaccines, when people were announcing, oh, here they are, and they're good, and there's no long-term effects, it's like it had to be untrue on its face because we haven't had any long term yet. We're still studying this. The way that cases are coded, if a person was admitted into an inpatient facility and they tested positive, then they were, quote, a COVID patient. And it was reported that, you know, half the people in the hospitals were COVID patients. Now, to be truthful, the ERs were full of people suffering from acute COVID and predominantly elderly people with compromised immune systems, the obese, and people with underlying health conditions, particularly respiratory issues. So this was a deadly virus. And I think the next wave of this debate is going to be, was it the vaccines that broke the back of this, or was it the natural evolution of the virus? And frankly, I don't think there's enough data out there to make that conclusion at this point.
The one thing I'll say from the beginning is that our country is made up of grown adults, and the government's not any smarter than the people. And there's no reason for the government ever to mandate a lockdown, because if it is truly dangerous out there, people will stay in their homes by their own free will. If people want a mask, they'll mask for their own free will. There is no reason for the government ever to intervene in our lives the way they did. There's no excuse for it. Even if it was the plague, you let people exercise their free will and go out and get the plague. It was just wrong from the start, regardless of the severity or not. Government mandated lockdowns are wrong, and you and I could probably connect on what the governors did when it came to elective procedures and the elimination of elective procedures being performed in communities where there was no COVID because a governor thought he was smarter than hospital administrators, and the damage that did to our populace. So I am very much a libertarian. I am hardcore libertarian when it comes to our rights. So I'm an Adam Smith economist, Milton Friedman, I don't think the government has any place in our lives other than maybe fixing the roads.
Which again brings me back to why I like your tweets, and you are an equal opportunity thrower of punches. It's all about common sense. And I like one where you say you're thinking about starting a political party called, quote, "Stop Spending American Dollars on Stupid Shit." I again encourage people to look up your Twitter and to follow it. It's called Show Me the Data. And you're not kind to former President Trump either, but you're not just jumping on the bandwagon. You're being thoughtful about your commentary. Before we move off COVID and some of the Twitter feeds, anything you want to add to that? Because I do want to talk to you about a couple of your postings on Substack.
No, I'm happy to move off of COVID.
Okay. All right. Great. Again, now on the Substack, this is also called Show Me the Data. And for those of you that are not yet Substack readers, I'd encourage you to do so. It's a little clumsy. When you first go to Substack, you look up a writer and it says, you know, do you want to give us your email? And below it, it says, no thanks. That doesn't mean that you stop there. Just hit no thanks and keep going. It means you get to read the stuff that's free that authors have not put behind a paywall. So, Corey, we've talked about your going off the grid. We've talked about some of your, and again, I mean this in a very complimentary way, near pugnacious tweets on that are just reek of common sense, like the movie, old movies, you know, slap cross face, thanks, I needed that. But you've written some things. You wrote about keeping evil out of our homes. What happened? What caused you to write that? And what's the takeaway lesson?
Let's see if I can talk about this without crying. Because it was a very emotional experience. So we had some basic common sense rules when it came to media in our house. Well, computers are only used in public spaces. There's no computers in rooms. My daughter only had something called a Gab phone. Gab phone has no data. There's no access to the internet. We were very strict about the media content. We don't give them unfettered access to the television. I grew up where my mom would stay up watching Footloose and then hit pause during the bad parts so that I could see the same TV shows my friends saw, but without seeing all the junk in it. And so we try to give our kids a very similar experience. And last year, my daughter's personality started changing, and it was just a really awful time in our house. It was just awful. And every night as I put her to bed, I'd ask her, is there something you're not telling me? Is there just something? I feel like there's something you're not telling me. She's like, no. And I always let her know, no matter what happens, I love you. You can do, no matter what you do, no matter what choices you make, I will always love you. There's nothing you can do that would make me stop loving you, because I could feel there was something. And then one day she was home and she was sick. And I went in her room and she had this fort, and she said she was reading in her fort, but I saw a laptop in there. And so I grabbed the laptop, and what ensued was this wrestling match. And it was weird. It was like something had possessed my daughter. Like, I've never seen this in my child before, where she just not, I had to physically like rip her off me, shove her out the door and lock the door behind so I could open the laptop. And I opened it up and there was pornography on the laptop. I mean, she's a 13-year-old kid. She's a sweet kid. And there's this, and it's anime. It's just, so I sat down with her and I let her know. I was like, look, this isn't your fault. There's evil people in this world trying to get at kids. It was her school computer, nonetheless, school computer. But she had figured out how to get around the firewalls to get to games because she wanted to play games in class because she was bored. And they put ads for that crud in the games. And that's how she got hooked on pornography. And it was about, I beat myself up over this. There's so many things I could have done differently. We had settings on all of our computers. We thought we were monitoring. We weren't. So we had a really real conversation. We went through this process and talked about the addiction of pornography and why it's important to break up with it. And we took it out a lot of other steps in our life. But from there, it started to become very just more interactive with our kids whenever they're on the computer. Because she was doing this at our kitchen table. She would just have the computer facing us.
Oh my goodness. And then
walk by, she'd close it. So like the fact this was happening at my kitchen table, it was just rips my heart out. And not from a betrayal standpoint, but just the what she was doing to herself. She wasn't happy. She wanted me to find out. She felt relieved and she was grateful. You know, it was a tough time.
How's she doing now?
She's great. She's great. She's a delight to have around. Completely different kid. She's a good girl.
What advice would you give to other parents who's, you know, the world's online, their kids play games online, they play games with their friends online. What advice would you give to other parents?
First, you're the parent. You're not their friend. And the easiest thing to do is to give them unfettered access. The easiest thing to do is let them watch whatever they want. It's hard. It's really hard to be a parent right now. It's hard to be as involved. It's not the 80s. We grew up in the 80s and the parents just like, let us like, no, there are so many evil people trying to get to your kids. You pay for the device. It's your rules. You pay for the internet. It's your rules. Like you are a parent. And that's the first thing I'd say to parents that typically push back. Well, their friends, who cares what their friends are doing? I'm not their friend's parents. The other piece is don't be complacent. I was complacent. I thought we had all the filters, all the monitors. I thought I was very complacent in the tools that I had bought. And it was my complacency that let this get into our house.
So you posted again about leaning into Black History Month. What's the story behind that?
Well, I feel like as conservatives, we fight the wrong way. We fight incorrectly. We fight fights that we can't win. Black History Month isn't going to go away. So let's own Black History Month. And this actually started back years ago when Instagram, when everyone was posting the black square on Instagram, you know, saying that they stood in solidarity with Black History Month. Well, instead of posting black squares, I started posting pictures of black people from history, like Harriet Tubman, and items about them, but they were all conservatives. So I was outwoking. I'm like, I can outwoke my friends. I can outwoke all of you. Every day I'm going to highlight a different black person in history. And then they couldn't push back on it because as people like Sowell, where you can say, anyhow. So that's where I got this idea was that black square on Instagram being like, all right, we can't fight it. We can't say that black square is stupid. So let's own it. Let's own this argument. And so what I did at home is I created a slideshow of black historical figures. We listened to music from you know, black musicians. And we'd watch certain documentaries like the Thomas Sowell documentary, which I love. We watched Glory, you know, giving them this perspective of black history that isn't necessarily the perspective that's taught in schools. And the day after we watched the Sowell documentary, the day after, my daughter in her social studies class was told to choose a black American that's won multiple awards to do a report on. And all of her peers were choosing like Beyonce and Barack Obama, and she chose Sowell. And so teacher had no idea who Thomas Sowell was. And so she was able to teach her teacher and her class about this marvelous black American that she wouldn't have known if we had not said, okay, we're doing black history and the schools aren't teaching our kids, so we got to teach our kids.
Black history is complicated. And let's make no mistake that there is racism in the country and in our society. If you look from the now, by the way, I've read the 1619 Project and it's garbage. They, amongst the other things that'll make you snort and laugh out loud, is because certain people in certain businesses owned slaves and they did a thing that kind of looked like a spreadsheet. And since businesses today use spreadsheets, therefore it's that the businesses today are practicing racism. Now, I kid you not.
Excel's racist. I'm going to use that at work. Dude, I can't be Excel's racist. Sorry, I'm not touching that.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Right. So, and indeed, where at the time of the, you know, first colonials arriving, what the status of slavery was around the world, we have to be really honest about this, that, you know, in our founding documents, a black person's 3/5 of a person. It was legal in half our country to have the horror of owning another human being based on their pigmentation. In my lifetime, we had segregation, Jim Crow laws. We had to pass the civil rights laws. It has been a different history, and there has been abuse. There has been out and out murders, and there's been clearly discrimination, and the vestiges of that still exist today. But it's not a monolithic community or a monolithic voting bloc. Yet I basically, my cut on it is I see white liberals trying to hijack the Black experience for any number of programs. And I see, you know, other ethnicities trying to tailgate onto the horrible history in that Black Americans have faced. And Black Americans, we do owe a duty of opportunity. But, you know, frankly, everybody else came here on their own volition, and they did not have broad laws that relegated them to being owned. But that doesn't stop in California, where Larry Elder, the son of a janitor from South Central Los Angeles, was tagged as a white nationalist. So these hate roles that are thrown out, racist, misogynist, transphobe, white supremacist, etc., all they're designed to do is not to remedy an ill, but to try to squash free speech. And that's what the intent is, and that's what we're seeing. You get the last word on this one, and then I want to ask you about one of your other posts that you have here.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So one of the other things that you wrote about is the student loan speech that Republicans need to give. And I have a take on this. I'd love to hear your take, and we can chat about this for a minute.
So again, I feel like conservatives go at the problem from the wrong angle. They go at it from a losing angle. They need to be more creative. Instead of saying, I don't want that, own it. Yes, kids, you're right. You got screwed. You took out loans that you shouldn't have taken out. Those colleges took advantage of you. They took advantage of you. The taxpayer didn't take advantage of you. The college you went to took advantage of you. Georgetown, they took advantage of you. So they should pay you back. You're right. They should pay you back. They have these nice fat endowments. You're right. Georgetown needs to give you their money back, your money back. Not me. I didn't con you. I didn't tell you to go to college. I didn't tell you to take out the loan. And I didn't make a dime off that loan that you took out. But Georgetown did. And I don't know why I'm picking on Georgetown, but it's what came up to mind. But they're the ones that get to pay you back. And that Republicans, I mean, you start going after those endowments, the libs are going to drop the whole thing because they're in the pockets of higher education. But I say we tax the endowments to pay for student loan forgiveness, get taxpayers out of the student loan business. It's the whole reason why tuition has been astronomically inflated is because it's been subsidized by taxpayers. Like everything is subsidized by taxpayers. But just giving them forgiveness does not fix the problem. And that's the fact that you and I are underwriting these loans and we shouldn't be.
Well, I would be in agreement with you in large measure. And I think there's a lot of parallels with healthcare financing and financing of higher education. So much of the healthcare spend is based on what a third party will do, which often removes the moral hazard about whether a purchase is made or not. Now, notwithstanding that much of medical care and even health maintenance, health promotion things are really not optional as a higher education might be. But the parallel is that with all this money coming in that, hey, someone else is going to pay for it and made it too easy. And I think that the immorality of places of higher learning, going to a 17-year-old and saying, here, sign this, that child and their parent doesn't know the difference between a $7,500 loan and a $75,000 loan. And I would imagine the presumption is I'm going to get a job based on this degree and I'll be able to pay this back. And instead, they're saddled with debt. So they come out of college and instead of buying homes and refrigerators and cars and building a life, they're back in the basement trying to pay off the loan. But wait, the loan payments, so that they're not too hard, can be tempered to someone's income, even if that payment doesn't cover the interest. So that big loan they come out with of $100,000 can easily balloon to $150,000 and $200,000, and people find themselves in their 60s with that note. Now, to your point, who's got the money? It was the college that hoodwinked the people in the first place and the underwriter who then lobbied that these loans could not be discharged by personal bankruptcy. What happens in the real world? You go in to apply for credit. That person that's going to make you that loan says, can this person pay me back? Do they have the means to do it? Do they have a credit history? Because if they don't pay me back, I'm going to lose on the loan. But in higher education, since the loan can't be discharged, they loan money to people that are patently uncreditworthy. They have no employment history. They have no assets, no visible means of paying that loan back. Yet now the idea is, let's stick to taxpayers. I like the idea. Excise tax on the endowments of Harvard, UC Berkeley, University of Michigan. The problem that we've gotten into can't be dumped over on the taxpayers. I'm with you on the solution.
And then bringing it full circle with COVID, if you look at what those institutions did financially, 2020, 2021, their operating costs plummeted. And some of them used to be in the red, they were in the black. They made a ton of money in reduction of operating costs. And then their endowments made record-breaking gains. COVID was a windfall for higher education, and the students got screwed. So yeah, let's just hold these universities accountable and get out of this business.
And what happened in healthcare as the payment system changed? It did start impacting the cost curve a bit, again, a little more complex. But if you took that loan money out of the college equation, the colleges would be forced to come up with a business model that made sense, that the consumer could afford. And other writers have talked about the layers of administrators and bureaucracies that they've got on the campuses. And of course, we've covered some of those issues as well here on the Common Bridge. So again, the name of the Substack is Show Me the Data. The name of the Twitter feed, also Show Me the Data. I encourage you to wade in, be polite. And if you don't see things the same way that Corey does, offer your perspective, because I think she's going to come back to you, because she doesn't seem to have a canned approach to anything, which is what we like to see on the Common Bridge. And of course, if you have an opposing view, we'd love to have you as a guest as well. And perhaps there's another solution out there. And that's what we want to do, is have discussions about what the issues of the day are and what the solutions are.
I think being right is a problem. I love being shown I'm wrong. I love being shown that I got something completely wrong, because it's like your eyes open. You're like, oh man, I was wrong about that. That's awesome. So please, tell me I'm wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Show me the data. This has been a great conversation. I can't wait to see our audience's reaction. So Corey, this has been a great conversation. If we've covered everything that you wanted to go over today, is there any closing comments for the listeners, readers, and viewers of the Common Bridge?
So one of the tricks I had on Twitter to never getting banned, but be able to say what I want to say, because I never got suspended in my whole 2 years, and I said was to ask it as a question and pose questions instead of making statements. So that's how I got around to questioning authority and using data and not coming across as so combative and not getting banned, is that I was able to take hard statements and turn it into a question. So that would be my bit of advice. If you're in a situation and you're you disagree vehemently and want to say something, figure out how to say what you want to say in the form of a question in order to have that important conversation.
It's a great advice for everybody on social media, as we learn how to absorb the communication of that very powerful platform series. We've been talking to Corey of the Substack page, Show Me the Data, and the Twitter feed of the same name, Show Me the Data. I encourage you to follow her, encourage you to engage in some good, polite discourse and exchanges. And with our guest today, this is your host, Rich Helpe, signing off on the Common Bridge.
Thanks for joining us on the Common Bridge. Subscribe to the Common Bridge on Substack.com or use their Substack app, where you can find more interviews, columns, videos, and nonpartisan discussions of the day. Just search for the Common Bridge. You can also find the Common Bridge on Mission Control Radio on your Radio Garden app.